Individual interest. This opened possibilities for a new relationship between rulers and ruled, whereby an impersonal state related equally to individual inhabitants regardless of rank. Changes in theology, science, and art had articulated new ideas of the individual since the later 13th century. Moral hostility to singularity persisted and was reinforced by the Reformation, which emphasized confessional conformity, including lifestyle as well as belief. Nonetheless, well before Anglophone writers like Bernard Mandeville or Adam Smith, Germans expressed positive interpretations of self-interest. Leonhard Fronsperger, a military clerk and noted writer, argued in 1564 that divergent individual needs actually created harmony by encouraging mutual interdependence. The development of imperial taxation, meanwhile, encouraged the relaxation of earlier restrictions on private wealth creation, since this could help meet obligations to the empire. However, German discussions took a different path from those among English-speaking philosophers like John Locke, who developed the idea of rights relating directly to individuals, rather than deriving indirectly through association with a household, community, or other corporate group. Adam Smith subsequently extended this into liberal economic theory by arguing that individual wealth creation would add to overall prosperity, rather than simply representing the theft of someone else's share of supposedly finite wealth. The market, not the state, should regulate society. The state was reduced to being a night watchman, guaranteeing only minimal order and security. The position remained reversed in most discussions in the empire, where territorial authority was itself a product of corporate rights and could not be so easily disentangled from the social order. The state, not the individual, retained the initiative. In practice, new ideas of individualism simply added to existing arguments for state intervention to micromanage lives and make people happy, if necessary, by force. Attempts by writers like Heinrich Justi to reduce the state's role merely envisaged the ideal of a well-oiled machine entangling rather than liberating individuals. The basic contradictions in these arguments carried over into 19th century German liberalism. The state was to remove barriers to individual happiness by dismantling protectionism and facilitating a free market. Yet to do so required ever greater powers to overcome the considerable popular opposition to such measures. Community. Villages. The continued identification of the individual with collective happiness owed much to the strength of communal social organization. This developed in Scandinavia, France, and elsewhere, so the differences between these countries and the empire are a matter of degrees rather than absolutes. But their specific expression in a corporate socio-political order was nonetheless significant. Communal political forms emerged relatively early in the empire as a defining element alongside lordship. They were weakest during the early Middle Ages, but grew stronger around the 11th century, expanding rapidly during the 14th century to peak around 1500. If their subsequent development was checked by the expansion of princely governments, both urban and rural communes remained generally stronger than in other countries, and persisted well beyond 1806. The vast majority of the empire's inhabitants lived in scattered hamlets into the 10th century. The 200 to 300 people living on a typical Carolingian manor were described as a single familia, but their structure was not communal, since important decisions were reserved for the lord or his steward, while a significant proportion lived segregated as slaves. The few more genuine communities that existed were all religious houses like monasteries and convents, though again, these usually also contained subordinate dependents. Several different kinds of settlement might be combined in one place, notably royal palaces that also functioned as farms and often had attached religious houses. True villages only emerged with the economic changes of the mid-11th century, coupled with the contraction of domains and the disappearance of the entirely servile population. They were given focus through the spread of church building and incorporation of more rural areas into parishes. Parishes were not corporations, because they depended on the church hierarchy, but their development helped forge communal identity, especially as Gregorian reform stressed their role in selecting clergy. Even if clerical appointments remained largely in the control of lords, and later patricians, other subsequent theological developments periodically reinforced parish identity, notably the spread of more formalized communal worship after 1215. Various forms of village developed, but nucleated settlements were fairly typical, and consisted of houses grouped around a church, surrounded by gardens, and often an outer perimeter demarcated by an earth wall or wooden palisade to protect against strangers and wild animals. Beyond this, lay land organized in the three-field system, plus common assets like meadows and woods. Towns. Towns contracted in the Romanized areas during late antiquity, as the dwindling population could no longer defend settlements that remained tempting targets for raiders. Many bishops abandoned their diocesan towns to escape the Vikings during the 9th century, further hastening urban decline. In Italy, this process accelerated the incastellamento, or construction of castles in more defensible sites, proliferating the fortified places that made it so difficult for later emperors to establish firm control there. Nonetheless, all 107 Italian episcopal towns in the 12th century could claim continuous occupation since ancient Rome, while the presence of a bishop also ensured continuity in Germany's oldest urban settlements. Mainz, Trier, Cologne, Worms, Speyer, and Strasbourg. Kings and lords often appear in annals as founders of medieval towns, though of course the real work was done by the inhabitants. Nonetheless, political factors need to be added to purely materialist and functionalist explanations for urban development. For example, Pavia, Ravenna, and Rome all owed their importance, in part, to continuous favor by the Lombards, Byzantines, and Carolingians, respectively. Thanks to their continuous existence, Italian towns already enjoyed considerable advantages over their equivalents north of the Alps, especially once their populations began to grow during the 10th century, after four centuries of stagnation. These towns were both larger and had a higher proportion of legally free inhabitants, who were able to use their relative wealth to acquire rights and property in the surrounding countryside. Politics also favored this process, because Carolingian rule had established fewer powerful lords compared to Germany. This established a lasting distinction between the town and its surrounding area, now identified as the Count's Land, Contado. The extension of urban control over the hinterland was checked during the reign of Hugo of Arles, who won the support of the Italian episcopate by selling them many of the count's rights over both town and countryside around 940. Although bishops generally held both jurisdictions for the next century, the upper strata of the urban population were emerging as their lesser vassals. Gregorian reform accelerated this trend by reinforcing this group's claims to participate in selecting bishops and generally to exercise greater influence over their own affairs. Carolingian expansion saw the foundation of new towns north of the Alps around important monasteries to serve as bases for the expanding ecclesiastical structure. The new settlements formed around a cathedral, sometimes with other religious buildings, sited to structure the town in the shape of a cross. Defensive palisades and ditches demarcated town from country by the 10th century. Ottonian patronage provided an additional spur with the grant of toll and market rights to many bishops, enabling episcopal towns to develop as regional economic centers. This trend peaked in the mid-11th century as the Salians granted exemptions from servitude to attract additional inhabitants. The Salians, and especially their Staufer successors, also increasingly favored towns on their royal progresses rather than rural palaces or monasteries. Towns expanded to incorporate a market square with merchants and artisans' houses within an expanded fortified ring. Speyer, for instance, already grew tenfold during the Ottonian era, while in total, 130 new market towns developed along the Rhine and Danube across this period. Although generally newer than Italian towns, those north of the Alps were often more advanced economically at this point. Middle and lower Rhenish towns engaged in long-distance trade, while those in Flanders and Brabant were already centers of cloth manufacturing from 1020. Most Italian towns remained only regional centers into the 12th century, apart from Genoa and Venice, which grew rapidly through the trade opportunities opened by the Crusades after 1096. Meanwhile, a new type of urban foundation spread east from Lorraine in the 12th century, as secular lords now also established towns endowed with immunities directly from their foundation, in a deliberate attempt to attract wealth and labor by offering an attractive new settlement. The Zähringer founded Freiburg, literally free town, in the Breisgau in 1120, while other early examples include Lübeck, 1143, Munich, 1158, and Leipzig, 1161. Whereas there were only 200 German towns in 1025, there were over 600 by 1150 and 1,500 by 1250. Of these, 150 were in royal lands, 38 controlled by bishops, and the rest under lordly jurisdiction. By contrast, very few new towns were founded in Italy, with the most famous being Alessandria, established collectively by the Lombard League in 1168, and named after their ally, Pope Alexander III. This is not surprising, since Italy already had around 300 large towns, whose population was expanding four times faster than anywhere else in Europe. By 1300, there were 20 cities in north and central Italy with at least 20,000 inhabitants, while Florence had 100,000 and Milan 175,000. By contrast, rural settlements expanded in numbers, but rarely significantly in size, across 1,000 to 1,300. Colonization and migration transformed the East European countryside from scattered hamlets to villages during the 12th century, when many Slavic villages were also reorganized through new legal codes. Migration drew off population from the West, where settlement size and numbers stabilized both overall and in the relation between the number of people and the area of land that could be worked without having to travel too far each day. Less favorably sited settlements were now abandoned, though lords continued to offer inducements to attract migrants to more difficult areas like the Black Forest. The number of new towns peaked, along with eastern colonization, in the period 1220 to 1320, with the foundation of Berlin, Frankfurt an der Oder, Breslau, Gdansk, and Königsberg. Many of the towns established at this point were not entirely new, like Stuttgart, which expanded from a village under the patronage of the Württemberg counts. New foundations continued across 1320 to 1450, but on a much reduced scale. Early towns often encountered significant difficulties through being endowed with insufficient land or access to water. Later efforts granted more land to enable the first settlers to grow their own food. 12th century foundations also addressed social questions through charters regulating relations to lords. Many of the new towns beyond the Elbe deliberately copied charters from so-called mother towns to the west. Although new itself, Lübeck served as the exemplar for 100 other towns after the 13th century. While Magdeburg law was used from East Central Europe to Russia, and Nuremberg and Vienna were copied across Bohemia, Moravia, and the Balkans. Elsewhere, cities like Frankfurt served as models for smaller towns in their region. Growth ended abruptly with the Black Death. The total number of German settlements fell by 40,000 to 130,000 across 1340 to 1470, with contraction reaching 40% in upland areas like Hessen, Thuringia, and the Austrian Alps, compared to 10% in more favorable lowland regions, especially between the Lower Rhine and Weser and on the Middle Elbe. Around 4,500 settlements were also abandoned in Bohemia and Moravia. Yet losses in Italy were only 10 to 25%. Towns suffered badly during the plague itself, but fared better overall in retaining their size. By 1450, the empire had around 2,500 towns, including 88 Swiss and 150 Austrian ones, but excluding those in Italy. Whereas there was one town per 400 square kilometers in southwest Germany, the ratio in the northeast was 1 per 1,000 square kilometers. Most had fewer than 2,000 inhabitants, while only 5% had over 5,000, and just 30 towns had more than 10,000. Cologne was the largest, with 40,000 inhabitants. Pre-modern urban settlement was now essentially complete, with only 200 more towns added by 1800, largely as princely residences, garrisons, or refugee settlements, like Mannheim, Potsdam, and Erlangen. The urban proportion of the population also remained broadly constant, rising only from 20 to 25% across 1300 to 1800, with the highest density in Holland and Brabant, where the proportion was already 40 to 50% in 1514. Further development remained constrained by agricultural productivity. A medium-sized village produced only sufficient surplus to feed 25 town dwellers in the late 16th century, meaning that at least 10,000 villages were required to sustain the German urban population. Despite differences between Germany, Italy, and the Low Countries, urban development in the empire broadly conformed to a Western and Central European pattern, influenced by how politics and agriculture were organized. Growth during the High Middle Ages had created a multitude of individually modest towns, compared to the pattern in Southeast Europe and the Islamic world, which was dominated by far fewer but individually larger cities. 14th century Cairo already had 600,000 inhabitants, a figure not reached in Germany or Italy until well into the 19th century. The emergence of the household. More obviously communal self-government only emerged from the 11th century, beginning in Italian towns and becoming general by 1200. This complex process frequently pitted lords and commons against each other, and many of the concessions were only won through violent protest. However, civic emancipation was never a singular glorious act, but instead developed incrementally, often over several centuries, with some rights acquiring new meaning with changed circumstances. Most privileges were intended to promote a town's development, not free its inhabitants, while lords often retained residual rights. The new freedoms were never equal or universal liberty, but instead local and particular liberties that bound the community and its inhabitants within the wider web of rights constituting the empire's legal order. Communal government in rural areas involved the transfer of decision-making power from a lord or steward to villagers, especially through the demarcation of access rights to specific resources. The village assumed an identity as a collective actor, but not all its inhabitants could participate in decisions. Communal government rested on households, which became the fundamental socio-political unit in the empire and the primary site for production, consumption, and, for non-clerical houses, reproduction. Households originated in the Frankish development of the hide as a family package of rights and resources. Villages developed around these households by 1200, manifest by the spread of more solid house-building techniques, employing a sturdy timber frame or even stone construction. The house assumed a semi-sacred character, with special rituals surrounding its construction, and especially in setting the roof. Door keys symbolized the power to control entry. Biblical examples encouraged a potent household ideology resting on the ideal of a married couple. This ideal underwent subtle shifts, especially in how gender roles were defined, as well as the rediscovery during the Renaissance of ancient ideas of good farm management, economia, and later this received heightened religious moral emphasis with the Reformation. Throughout, the household was celebrated as a place of safety and warmth, symbolized by its hearth, now solidified with stone or brick chimneys. The household was supposed to provide materially for all its members, hence the internal moral economy. However, it was also hierarchical under the patriarchal paterfamilias, or Hausvater, responsible for economic coordination and maintenance of the peace of the house, Hausfrieden. It is scarcely surprising that the household became a potent political metaphor and a key element in the debates over the common good from the High Middle Ages. Household members were expected to behave responsibly so as not to damage their collective reputation and, with that, access to valuable resources. External peer pressure encouraged this through criticism of drunken and other bad householders as undermining overall communal well-being. Marriage remained restricted until at least one of the prospective partners could inherit or otherwise obtain the property necessary for a viable autonomous existence. The development of taxation increased the emphasis on maintaining individual household viability, since the most usual way to collect direct levies was to apportion quotas to towns and villages, which were expected to find the money themselves by requiring all householders to contribute. Moreover, as we have heard, households featured at all levels of society, from humble peasants to the Casa d'Austria. Although households were also sites for private emotions, it was their public aspect that was idealized until the emergence in the 1770s, in some places, of the bourgeois family as a private domestic sphere. Rural self-government. The development of communal government involved enfranchising male householders according to their property value in towns, or whether they leased or owned larger farms in villages. This established a link between taxation and representation, but at the communal level, rather than higher up in any representative assembly. Those who were not economically independent were generally excluded from enfranchisement in the communal institutions. Cottagers, landless laborers, unmarried younger men, and generally the entire female population, though widows were allowed to represent households in some areas. Rural self-government initially emerged around 1130 on the empire's periphery in areas where there were both fewer lords and fewer people generally, along the lower Austrian frontier and in the North Sea marshes and those of the Weser and Elbe. These were all areas of recent settlement where pioneers were rewarded with corporate rights. Subsequent waves of migrants carried these arrangements across the Elbe, as well as into upland areas. The problems of starting a new life in often difficult circumstances undoubtedly contributed to a more collaborative approach, at least initially. Meanwhile, existing Alpine communities along transit routes bargained better terms by cooperating to keep passes free from obstacles, by clearing rocks and maintaining bridges. Many lords were happy to promote self-government because this freed them from having to manage local affairs, which were now handled by village mayors, assisted by selected householders. Criminal jurisdiction usually remained in the lord's hands, while the inhabitants generally still leased his land. Territorialization extended other forms of jurisdiction during the 14th century, including powers to levy taxes, and later also militiamen and conscripts. Thus, the process through which communes acquired rights was part of the wider development of the empire and territories, and not in opposition to this. The commune was at one and the same time a corporate association of agrarian producers and an instrument of feudal lordship to ensure the functioning of feudal exploitation and maintenance of feudal order. These developments continued in the West into early modernity, and though interrupted by second serfdom east of the Elbe, villages remained important in that region too. Hereditary mayors developed in Brandenburg villages by the 14th century under the Margrave's jurisdiction. The Margrave transferred his supervisory rights to his nobles around 1500 in return for tax grants collected by the communes at their inhabitants' expense. As the old mayoral families died out, lords replaced them with their own appointees. Saxony and other areas east of the Elbe saw similar developments. However, even mayors appointed by lords were still members of their village community. Lords relied on them and the family patriarchs to organize serf labor from the village's younger sons. Inhabitants retained rights of appeal to princely courts and successfully challenged excessive lordly demands because princes wanted to protect households as their primary tax unit. Princely intervention rarely lightened the overall burden, but did generally shift it from lordly exactions to territorial taxes. Brandenburg, Prussia went further by 1733 and established the state's right to conscript peasants as soldiers, only releasing them back as agricultural laborers on its own terms. The Hohenzollerns converted their own domains into hereditary leases in 1702, allowing their new tenants to elect village officials. Many Junkers subsequently commuted labor service into paid employment, recognizing this as more productive. Some Brandenburg communities benefited from rising grain prices, accumulating sufficient wealth to buy their own knights' fiefs by the late 18th century. The Prussian General Law Code of 1794 confirmed communal autonomy, integrating villages as the lowest echelon of state administration. The situation was different in Bohemia, where the areas under Czech law gave fewer rights to communal institutions like village headmen and courts. Although the actual implementation of Czech law converged with German practice during early modernity, this was not always for the better. In practice, Bohemian lords were able to remove troublesome headmen, despite their hereditary tenure of office, in those parts of Bohemia under German law, such as Friedland. Headmen remained heavily dependent on lords for their economic livelihoods, since their incomes derived from lordly privileges like brewing rights, rather than wages. Nonetheless, communal institutions were just too useful for lords to ignore. As elsewhere, most lords were absentees and relied on the headmen chairing village courts to keep order and ensure the smooth running of the manorial economy. This necessitated a flexible response to peasant complaints, effectively granting headmen wide discretionary powers. The primary difference with the rest of the empire is instructive, as it demonstrates how local legal arrangements elsewhere were connected to the wider constitutional framework. Bohemia approximated more closely to the Western unitary kingdoms, with a flatter hierarchy of jurisdictions. Its villages remained largely outside state administration, which depended heavily on the noble-dominated provincial estates to raise taxes and recruits. Unlike most of Germany, Bohemian villagers did not have access to a separate hierarchy of princely and imperial law courts to obtain independent redress prior to Joseph II's Emancipation Patent in 1781. Civic Emancipation. The trend towards civic self-government resumed in Italy around 1000, after its interruption by the royal sponsorship of bishops during the previous century. As with its rural equivalent, towns often acquired greater autonomy through cooperation rather than conflict with lords, including the emperor. None of the empire's medieval royal families pursued a coherent policy of favoring towns to win burghers as alternative political partners to balance the lords. The royal families did not think in class terms, but instead responded to local circumstances, their main concern being to match general expectations for royal justice and morality. Their thinking also remained hierarchical, with senior lords already known to them personally as their natural partners. The emergence of the civic communal movement thus represents the failure not just of the monarch, but of all lords to widen the empire's consensual politics to accommodate new socio-economic forces. Imperial favor remained purely tactical. For example, Henry IV generally supported the Italian episcopate, not least because his Gregorian opponents usually backed those in episcopal towns who were already trying to unseat local bishops. However, Henry sided with the communal movement in Tuscan towns because these generally opposed Matilda of Canossa. Meanwhile, most burghers had no desire to assert their voice in managing the realm, but instead simply wanted more control over their own lives. The crucial step in civic emancipation was the acquisition of the count's rights over a town when these had passed into the hands of the local bishop. Some bishops were happy to be free from the responsibility of protecting their town and becoming dragged into the innumerable problems arising from rapid urbanization. Towns thus communalized these jurisdictions by assuming responsibility for protecting themselves and handling internal justice and other public functions. This explains why civic autonomy began earlier in Italian than in German towns, which were generally smaller and so more dependent on lordly protection. It also explains why relations quickly soured in many Italian cities, as citizens discovered that the bishops' or counts' continued presence conflicted with their internal self-regulation. Cremona's inhabitants ejected their bishop in 1036 and extended the city walls to enclose the episcopal compound. Likewise, towns resented the presence of royal palaces and garrisons as extraterritorial enclaves disrupting their jurisdiction. As we have heard, the Pavians famously tore down the royal palace for this reason in 1024. Over the next two centuries, citizens used their growing collective wealth to buy out royal rights to exercise justice or demand accommodation in their city. Gregorian reform stimulated civic emancipation through its sustained critique of allegedly corrupt and immoral senior clergy and the secular lords accused of protecting them. Burghers increasingly asserted themselves as morally superior to both lords and clergy, notably in Milan, where the urban Patarines movement temporarily expelled the archbishop between 1042 and 1044. The Patarines had specific local roots, but also exemplified a general belief amongst townsfolk that self-government was essential to ensuring a peaceful, godly community. The ideal of the sworn godly community was often central to many towns' myth of origins, that they had been founded as a single collective act of the population gathering together to pledge a solemn association, coniuratis, For example, Bremen's city hall is supposedly the size of its original inhabitants, standing in a solid rectangle. This process was well underway before the investiture dispute gave it a significant impetus by the fragmentation of local power through the presence of schismatic bishops, as well as the higher-level contest between emperor and pope. The competing authorities often granted concessions in return for financial and military backing from cities. Henry IV and his son renounced claims for accommodation, Albergaria, to persuade Mantua and Verona to abandon Matilda of Canossa. The success of North Italian towns in freeing themselves from such obligations is demonstrated by the fact that none of their imperial palaces survived the High Middle Ages. A similar pattern set in north of the Alps, though a few decades later. Worms was the first German town to expel its bishop, when it sheltered Henry IV from his Saxon opponents in 1073. Henry rewarded it by exempting it from royal tolls in January 1074, in a move that was significant, since he gave this privilege to the inhabitants collectively, rather than just to favored individuals or merchants. As with all royal privileges in this era, it is important not to misconstrue this as simply the dissipation of central authority. Through his action, Henry demonstrated to his opponents that only he had the power to make such changes. Nonetheless, the corrosive impact of the investiture wars accelerated the grant of further privileges, increasingly also by other senior lords. Mainz's archbishop rewarded his burghers for rescuing him from Henry V in 1115 by granting them management of their own city. Other important episcopal towns emancipated themselves around the same time, including Cologne, Trier, Speyer, Cambrai, and Valenciennes. Changing legal practice gave civic autonomy a firmer shape. The 12th century saw a change from economic privileges associated with market rights, Marktrecht, to more general civic rights, jus civitas, or Staatsrecht, making the town and its inhabitants a legal corporation. For example, Strasbourg's bishop granted his city a 112-article civic law around 1131. An important element was the power to raise the taxes and labor needed to sustain self-rule and carry out tasks ranging from street cleaning to building new city walls. Towns could now make up their own rules without reference to a lord, even if he might retain some elements of jurisdiction, or, as was often the case in German episcopal cities, still possessed his own enclave around the cathedral, such as in Strasbourg and Bremen. Towns could also own property and assets, like a city hall, brewery, mills, smithy, poorhouse, plus land and woods beyond their walls. Increasingly, a town was called a Staat rather than a Burg, burg, borough, the latter deriving from the word for their lord's castle, though its inhabitants were still called burghers, burgensis, or burger. The term commune, Gemeinde, had emerged already during the 12th century as an abstract of its individual members, enabling them to interact in a world of lords as if they were a collective person. The initial transition to self-government after 1080 saw the establishment of consular regimes in which individuals were enfiefed with lordly rights on behalf of the commune, for example, in Asti and Milan. Consuls were drawn from the urban elite and were often already vassals of the local bishop or count, making the transfer of power easier since they were men whom the lord trusted. Consular government had spread to many Italian cities by 1130 and was adopted north of the Alps around 1200, for example in Cologne, Lübeck, and Utrecht. Consuls were soon counterbalanced by broader-based councils to stop what Napoleon, as consul of the French Republic, would do much later when he made himself dictator. A two-tier system emerged as the basic form of councils both sides of the Alps. Government was headed by a senior council, Rat, of 12 members, or multiples thereof, led by one or often two mayors simultaneously as a further check on personal rule. Members served fixed periods, usually with a prohibition on an immediate second term, and assumed the functions previously performed by the consul or the Lord's steward. The second tier was intended to control the first and consisted of a much larger citizens' assembly.